Welcome to the Property Management Mastermind Show with your host, Brad Larson. Brad owns one of the fastest growing property management companies in San Antonio, Texas. This podcast is for property managers by property managers. You'll hear from industry leading professionals on best practices, new ideas, success stories, and lessons learned. This is your opportunity to learn about the latest industry buzz surrounding property management, as well as tips and strategies to improve your business. Now here's your host, Brad Larson.
In today's show, I have Tim Melton here as a guest, and I want to give you a quick little background of Tim. And Tim's a property management company owner out of Phoenix and has several market locations. And his experience prior to getting into real estate, prior to getting into property management, came out of the automobile industry and basically dealing with cars and car dealerships and financing and all the things that go along with that. So it's quite a big deal to see that correlate nicely into what he's doing with the property management companies he's been growing. So let's take a listen to Tim right now. Let's go ahead.
Hello, Tim, and welcome to Property Management Mastermind. How are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us. So let's kick this off right away. And we want to talk about a little bit, some about your background, kind of where you started from, because where we're going with this conversation is how you are managing the number of companies you are and the number of doors you are with multiple markets. It's really quite impressive what you've been able to build. And this is kind of where we want to share that with the audience, how you did it and some of the challenges. So kind of give us a little bit of from your perspective, how you started in the background and kind of where you got to, at least in the beginning.
So we started in 2011, just like a lot of people out there. We're in the Phoenix market is where we were based and where we got things kicked off. And no real experience in it. I just saw the business opportunity there and kind of the market dynamics and how they were beneficial to starting a property management company. So we got going there in Phoenix and really got our foothold there, always with the intention of being in multiple markets. And the reason behind that was diversification, right? Being able to be in the same business, but diversifying ourselves across markets, just because Phoenix is very volatile. It's a roller coaster ride of a real estate market. So we wanted to venture out into other markets and didn't know exactly how we wanted to do that, but that was kind of always our intent.
Excellent. So one of the things we should expand on a little bit further is your background in what you did prior to getting into real estate. I think that's pretty fascinating, especially with what you did in the automobile industry.
Yeah.
So take some time and elaborate on that and some of the perspectives it gave you and some of the contacts you made.
Sure. Yeah, so I was fortunate enough to work on the corporate side for Vantile Auto Group. They recently sold to Berkshire Hathaway, so Warren Buffett. They managed or owned about 80 dealerships nationwide, mainly in the Sunbelt states, but a few kind of in the heartland there in Kansas City area. So I was fortunate enough to work with them in the corporate office and work somewhat closely with their owner. And very, very, very fortunate to see such big business and be able to see it at a high level and understand some of the reasons why they did things, which was, being able to be in the same industry but diversify across markets, there in the Midwest, susceptible to cattle prices or agricultural based things. So, how those went, so their business went. And so they branched out to Phoenix or Arizona. And now they're susceptible to construction and the things that go along with that. Texas, now they're susceptible to energy and those kinds of things. So, one of the situations where not everything's being heard at once. And so they can diversify themselves across markets and across local economies. And so I just kind of took what I was able to see there and applied it as best I could to, some opportunities that existed for us in the property management world.
You got to talk more about what they did as far as combining some of the dealerships.
So
that's really neat. And I think that translates directly into what you potentially are getting into or are into now with setting up different market centers. So dive into that with me a little bit and talk to me about that.
So our structure is not a franchise model. And that was one of my major takeaways from the time that I was able to have at the Vantile Group, is they're the local owner operator, the local general manager of their stores had an equity stake, a good equity stake in the local dealership. That person is incentivized to be entrepreneurial, incentivized to know the dynamics of the local market, and they're rewarded for increasing the value of the business because of that equity.
So the main corporate office had their own separate main entity, and that could have been one dealership in one city, and then they helped with equity share build other dealerships in even other states.
Exactly.
And he had a hand in their cookie jar, more or less, as an equity share partner, and they helped them grow.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, they, you know, carry along best practices, giving, you know, local smaller dealerships, places like Springfield, Missouri or something like that, access to insurance and finance products, service-based products that they may not necessarily have access to if they were just a small local mom and pop type deal. So they leverage economies of scale in that regard. They gave the local entrepreneur, the local general manager, the ability to be entrepreneurial to some degree. So they weren't super oppressive and, hey, here's the systems you're going to follow. Here's exactly what you're going to do.
Well, let's talk about that for an economies of scale, because people hear that, but they don't quite understand it.
Sure.
So let's dive into that. What does that mean? Economies of scale. So for example, it might be instead of four accountants at each dealership, you might have one main one and maybe three or four junior accountants.
Yeah. I mean,
do you have any examples like that you can
relating back to our business and exactly how we're structured? You know, I just kind of noticed that in some of the structures that were out there is that, you know, having the same name was, you know, whatever benefit was brought there. But there wasn't any consistency in having four different markets and four different accountants in each market. And, you know, four different ways of doing thing and four different liabilities if, you know, somebody left or you had to fire them or whatever. So, yeah, a lot of those types of things in our business, that's what we're back officing, which, you know, we're all a capacity-based business, you know, being service-related. And unused capacity is effectively, you know, diminishing profitability of your company. So that's economies of scale in our business, is being able to utilize unused capacity, standardizing some practices, and back officing as much as possible that's not necessary to be there in the local market, boots on the ground type thing.
So essentially what you saw in the automobile industry was they were able to combine forces.
Absolutely.
And when they did that, what did that do to the total value of their entity?
So, you know, it was a private company, and so the results of the sale, the multiple that they got, I don't know exactly. You know, just being somewhat familiar with the owner, I know that it's nothing that he was going to give away. It was a family-based business. His dad started the business in 1955, and so for him to sell the deal was going to have to be for a good multiple. And he did a great job of building that up, especially through the recession, purchased a bunch of dealerships. So in his ability, you know, comparative to like an AutoNation, which is a publicly traded company or something like that, my guess is their multiple was considerably greater. Actually, Warren Buffett specifically came out and said that Vantel Group's secret sauce was the local ownership by the general managers. So that was their secret sauce because it kept them engaged and kept them entrepreneurial.
If anything, would you think that relates to property management?
So there's a lot that can be related there. You know, I mean, completely different industries, and, you know, automotive is capital intensive and everything else. But, you know, just a lot of those concepts are concepts that we can, you know, we can take into our business. You know, the automotive industry was a fragmented mom and pop type of industry, you know, 30 years ago. And it's evolved into having a lot of kind of centralized ownership, you know, multiple location owned entities, things like that. So, you know, I think we're in the early stages of that evolution in our industry. So we can look to things like that, things like waste management that Wayne Huizenga, you know, took the garbage industry through, which is a service-based business, right?
Another good comparable. Talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm extremely fascinated with Wayne Huizenga and what he did there. You know, he was the guy, he started Blockbuster, you know, purchased Blockbuster early on, but most notably made a lot of his money in waste management. So it started here in West Palm Beach, Florida, just buying routes effectively. So he'd go find a guy that had a route of, you know, 50 customers, and he'd go buy those contracts from the guy. And so he just did that for a number of years, started in the early 60s, and just cobbled them all together, you know, different names and everything else, different entities, and eventually had the nation's largest trash route service. Obviously, he leveraged that with landfills and everything else, but he took a service-based business and just kind of rolled it up and gave them efficiencies, economies of scale, you know, customer acquisition strategies, all of that. Gave them, you know, name recognition in communities, but when there wasn't one before, and just revolutionized the industry. And very comparable to our business, because we're just completely a service-based business, and we're highly fragmented at the moment.
Extremely fragmented. Everybody's kind of doing their own thing. There is no economy of scale, meaning there's no cost reduction for our overheads, and a lot of opportunities there to not catch up on that unless we start to get together potentially as some sort of larger entity. So that takes me right into talking to you a little bit more about when you got into property management and real estate. Your original intentions are basically formed from those first experiences with the automobile industry. Is that correct?
So, yeah, you know, I could kind of see the end result of what we wanted to do. and I knew where I was at, but that chasm in between was the confusing part that is just having to be figured out on a day-to-day basis. And so, kind of started out began with the end in mind, so to speak, and have just continued to work towards that with whatever opportunities the industry kind of gives us.
So walk me through, you started in Phoenix, right? And you got up to a certain number of doors, X, and then you branched out, and then you branched out. So kind of walk us through that story.
So yeah, the first place that we wanted to go to a place that was somewhat familiar, close enough to us logistically that, it wasn't, a day plane ride or anything like that.
Well, before you went out elsewhere, what did you have in your original market?
Unit-wise?
Yeah, in Phoenix, and unit-wise, and staff-wise, kind of talk us through there.
So when we opened Las Vegas, which is our first remote market, in Phoenix, we had probably a little over 400 units.
Okay.
Staff-wise, we had all the positions covered, right? So we had accounting, we had business development, we had, obviously property management, maintenance, all that kind of stuff. So we had all the bases covered. We had systems associated with those bases and knew what we were doing in that regard. And so now we wanted to make it a little more complex and try it in another market. Knowing that when we opened another market that I wanted to operate with as little as overhead as possible, just because a big fancy office doesn't bring value to our clients or our tenants. Having an accountant in Las Vegas and having an accountant in Phoenix was, not going to be a wise move, especially because we started Vegas organically. So there was not a necessity to have multiple accountants, for example. So we needed boots on the ground type stuff. That's what I knew that I needed. So we just had to overcome the initial obstacles of getting licensed there. So understanding local licensing laws, Landlord-Tenant Act laws locally, and those kind of things, right? Getting the entity formed and all of that, understanding the relationship between the back office entity and our entity in Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And so just going through all those gymnastics and finally getting our feet under us and getting going to the point where we could sign up properties.
And so that was the first market, was going into Vegas. Mm-hmm. Along the same lines, you expanded into Dallas, mm-hmm, and expanded into Memphis. And that's kind of where you are to this point. Yep. Going back a little bit, what do you consider your first big break as you started to formulate? Did you get lucky? Did you stumble into, let's talk about personnel, for example. I think, you talked about some of your brokers and your business development person, some of those guys. Talk to me about some of the first big breaks of what you think really turned the corner for you guys.
So yeah, totally lucky in the regard of the timing of the business, right? Great time to start a property management company. I had no clue what I was doing. I was a decent marketer, decent sales guy. And so I knew how to, generate leads and sign up customers. Servicing them was the, kind of the problem after that. So that's where I learned, number one, lucky, being in a good market, the good dynamics of doing it. Starting a property management company there in Phoenix today, it's tough. It's a mature market. It's highly competitive. So it'd be a different story. So we started at a good time. So lucky break number one. And the other thing is it's all team, I mean, it's got nothing to do with me. Maybe I got some halfway decent ideas, but we just got a kick butt team. So, scored some good people early that have stayed on with us and continued to attract just rock stars, They see the vision, they're excited about it, they're growing professionally as well. But, I mean, it's got very little to do with me. We got a really solid team that they really push the ball forward.
Yeah, I've been to your office. I'm very impressed with the culture you have. And that's an overused term, I think, of recent, right, with property management companies around the NARPM community is culture, culture, culture. Sure. However, I really was impressed. You have several things going on in the office, like the goals you have are completely transparent. I mean, you have a giant, tell me about the goal thing you have in the center of your office.
So 10,000 units, that's the number that we're going to get to and what we're pushing for. And so we got a big house that's built in the middle of our office that will hold close to, depending on if our math is correct, 10,000 ping pong balls. And so every time we sign up a property, we drop a ping pong ball in there. And so each market has a different color. And it's just an exciting thing that we do. And it's out in front of us. And you got to walk around this big old house if you're walking through the middle of the office. It's no one thing. It's a combination of a million things. But I think it's the spirit of what we're doing. My kind of philosophy is that, we're in a kind of a tough business where you have a lot of unpleasant phone calls, unpleasant situations. You got to do an eviction. You got to do some dirty work. And so if you get off the phone from one of those, tough conversations and you're in an environment where people are giving you a hard time, your boss isn't nice to you or, something like that, then, you spend all day with these people and it needs to be a nice place. It needs to be fun. You need to be excited about what you do. So yeah, that's the environment that I create, I've been in jobs early on in my career, not the automotive industry, where you were just kind of asked to leave your brain in the car and come into the office and, you know, do the work. And so that's not our office. Everybody thinks, everybody's involved. We got, you know, we've always got five strategic initiatives every year that we work on, and our entire team's always broken up into those five. And so it doesn't matter if you're admin or whatever, you get your choice and you get to choose what strategic initiative you're in there on. And so, you know, we can have an admin in there that's working on business development ideas for four markets. And so they're involved. They're, you know, they're excited. These people are bought in and revved up about what we're doing.
That's pretty rare to get the admin involved in some of the higher level thinking stuff. I think that's genius. And you also said a word earlier, environment. I think that's part of the culture. If you're trying to understand what it is, go look at your work environment.
Yep.
If it's not fun, if it's not friendly, if it's not a good place to be, I think you're going to have an issue, because we hear again more about culture, 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 but what is it? And great examples, go to your office and you just have a good feel. You walk in there, it's friendly, it's open. It's just everybody seems to be having a, you know, a decent time. To go on a further story, talk about the radio thing.
Oh, so we've got a monthly contest, an employee of the month. We call it Amy of the month because our girl Amy at the office wins it a lot. So applause forms, right? So every week we've got a team meeting on Friday, and you fill out applause forms. So applause form is you're ratting somebody out for exemplifying a core value. So, you know, somebody does a good job of, you know, exemplifying one of our core values, you go fill out an applause form, drop it in the bucket, and then you get a point for the how many applause forms you get every week. So at the end of the month, all those roll up, and the person that got the most points. So number one, Fridays are cool because you never get tired of, you know, getting cheered for. And so, you know, we're willing to sit there for 45 minutes while we read these applause forms, talking about good things that people have done throughout the week. Because, you know, it's a tough business. You don't get a ton of thank yous from customers. So we give a lot of thank yous internally. And so those roll up to, you know, end of the month, somebody wins, somebody had the most points. And so we've got just a goofy, you know, 5 foot tall BMX trophy that's got nothing to do with anything, but it's just something that if you win, you get that trophy. You can decorate it as, you know, outlandish as you want. You put it up on your desk, you let everybody know, and you choose the music on Friday. So we always got music pumping in the office. And so, you know, sometimes we get a 22-year-old admin that wins it, and, you know, we're like, what in the world are we listening? We got Justin Bieber cranking in the office or whatever it is. So it's just, it's fun, it's exciting, it's goofy.
Because those two things contribute significantly to your goals. I mean, 10,000 doors is a lofty goal. And one thing I would appreciate about that is that people see the light at the end of the tunnel potentially versus coming to work and just making a boss a paycheck. And so what they're seeing is, man, look at what we're building. Look what we're doing here. We're building for this big goal, and we're riding this really cool wave, and we're part of a company that's actually striving to do something. Too often you're going to see in management specifically, you're going to see where they're just flatlining. They are just, they're not growing, they're not dying, they're just flat. And so I think they would appreciate the fact that you are striving to be better than everybody else, and they're going to ride that wave.
Sure. Well, and you know, everybody's got a choice there. I've got a choice to own the business or not own the business, right? I could sell it and go do something else. They've got a choice to work there or not work there. If they don't like it, they can go get another job really easily. They can come in and just give me notice and say they don't want to be there. So, you know, none of us are bound by marriage to this thing. So you got to make the relationship work, and you got to make it exciting, and you got to make it worthwhile. You know, you get up every morning and take a shower and go to work to do something. You might as well be supercharged about what you're doing.
Exactly. Let's talk about some of the challenges of the operations, because you're in four market centers.
Yep.
Now. You have a main market center in Phoenix and a satellite office in Vegas, Dallas, and Memphis. So talk about just maybe a few of the challenges of those operations.
So, you know, learning the, you know, from a growth standpoint, learning that the dynamics between the markets and understanding pricing, understanding what's quote unquote customary there, and how you'll be received. You know, Phoenix is kind of a flat fee, you know, very competitive market. Dallas is competitive, but the fees are a little higher that people are willing to pay. And so you can shortchange yourself. So just understanding the market dynamics from a growth perspective, and not shortchanging yourself, and also not overpricing yourself, being able to build points of difference in those markets to be attractive to new clients as well. But also, you know, you got places like Memphis where it snows and it's cold and things freeze, and you got winterized houses, and we don't exactly have to do that in Phoenix. So, you know, those are some of the differences you just have to have your eyes open to before you go into a market. And, you know, a lot of times we've gone into markets and not realized those things, and so figured them out the hard way. You know, I certainly don't have everything figured out, but those, you know, those are some things to consider and look at, and where the challenges really come from. You know, we minimize the amount of personnel that we have to have in those markets. You know, those markets, you know, it's boots on the ground type people, so they convert clients, they go on appointments, they're leasing, inspections, things like that. So, you know, if you, just like anything, if you make a bad hire, or you know, you're not including them in the culture, or you know, something like that, that makes things tough for you, right? If a market goes dark because your two people there decided they don't like you, that's tough. So, you know, just keeping a pulse on there. And so we do that through regular meeting rhythms, daily, weekly, and monthly meetings, you know, with different topics on each. So you can get a pulse to where people are at.
So essentially, kind of paraphrase what it is so people understand it, because you know, we understand it potentially, but let's kind of break it down. Sure. You have people in each market. You have one or two people in Memphis, for example, and a lot of the back office operations are being done in your call center or your office, your main office in Phoenix.
Right.
Is that correct?
Correct.
So talk about what's being handled away from the main market. So what's being done in Phoenix for the other three market centers you have?
So all of the unlicensed activity is taken care of in Phoenix, right? So if it doesn't require a real estate license, we do it there in Phoenix, for the most part, obviously, if it's not boots on the ground type of deal. So all of our licensed activity, negotiating contracts, signing contracts, those types of things are taken care of by our local licensees within their respective markets. And the administrative items, which is an all-encompassing term in property management, the administrative items are taken care of in Phoenix. So that's what our team does in Phoenix. So HOA notices, violations, you know, maintenance, accounting, owner statements, all of those kind of things, initial lead, receiving and follow up and that kind of a deal. It's all taken care of there in Phoenix. And the purpose of Phoenix is to set up and make the people in the other markets successful. So just recognizing a lot of things that exist in property management as being weak operationally, is we really wanted to make sure that our markets are strong operationally by centralizing as much as we could.
So some of the naysayers out there would say, well, my owner is going to call who then? Who's my owner going to call? Who's their point of contact? You know, my owners won't accept that you're in a different market, you answering know, the phone. How do you?
Yeah, so that's very, very, very valid. You know, and I had a lot of those fears initially as well. And it's almost, you know, obviously they want to know that somebody lives there. So that's very important for them. But the next most important thing to them is that the thing gets done, whatever the thing is, and that it gets done well and it gets done correctly. And so they don't care where that person is. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think 5 years ago, it would have been a little tougher than it is today. People are just becoming, you know, I mean, we're in the Uber economy, we're in the Airbnb economy, where a lot of this stuff is a little more acceptable and people's minds have changed. So they aren't necessarily concerned with that. And we've got investors that have properties in each of the markets, and they love the fact that they've got one point of contact, that their property manager is that. They're a manager in the sense that they're not a doer. They're not the one going to the property. They manage the teams that are doing the things that need to be done associated with it. So whether it's maintenance, whether it's leasing, whatever it is, they are, you know, they're driving they're the driving force behind getting that stuff done. They're not the doer. So the clients actually like it.
That's a neat expansion opportunity. So a couple things there. In my opinion, I think as long as the owners reach somebody via phone or email, as long as somebody's answering the phone and somebody's returning emails, I think they're happy. When it goes quiet and they can't get in touch with anybody, then they get ticked off. Even if they reach somebody and they don't know the answer, they're okay because they reach somebody and they'll go find the answer. So let's take another scenario. Because you have built this organization and I come up to you and say, hey, I've got 20 homes in El Paso. Can you manage those? What would be your initial reaction?
So, you know, being in El Paso, just understanding...
Is that a bad example? Let's pick any you know, major, minor city in the U.S. and somebody ran up to you and said, you know, you guys are managing my homes in Phoenix and I have a chance to acquire a bunch of properties in Idaho. Pick a town. Can you manage those?
So, yeah, because of our structure, it gives us the ability to deploy to any market quickly, right? Because of the success of that market isn't necessarily 100% dependent on the local person. So you have the gymnastics of getting licensed wherever it is, But if, you know, and the number's about 150, if somebody's got 150 units somewhere in a somewhat attractive market, we can go there, make money, and, you know, do a good job for them, and it's worthwhile for everybody to do
so that. 150, expand on that. You've done all the numbers front, sideways, and left and right, and that's where it's going to be. Is 150 is your break-even point?
Yeah, that's the minimum. So we're making money at 150, and, you know, that's kind of the minimum that we'd go into a new market for. And we do have that ability. You know, for example, in Memphis, you know, we got approached by an investor that had 300 units over there. We're able to open up an operation there, just, you know, obviously getting licensed and having to go through all that. But it was an opportunity that made sense for us just because the unit count was correct and all that. So that was kind of our foray into that market, was that exact scenario.
Almost fell in your lap to a certain extent.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. That's one of your big breaks, as we talked about.
Sure.
That's really cool to get into the Memphis market like that, especially with a... That's a neat story as well. Expand on the type of person that is owning that portfolio in Memphis.
So yeah, and Memphis is a different dynamic. You know, we were able to listen to Douglas Skipworth yesterday, and you know, all the success he's had there. And I mean, God bless him. It's a tough place to manage much properties. Just because, you know, and I can't say if we would have started in Memphis, then that would just be the norm. But we started in Phoenix, and you know, so we've got a lot of really nice houses. Our average rental rate's almost $1,300, and so that's 2 times what the average rental rate is in Memphis. So it is. So it's just a different dynamic that you've got to understand and deal with over there. And so yeah, that's not an institutional investor, but a larger investor that appreciates something different. You know, so that was a fun opportunity for our team to really step up our game reporting wise, because they operate it like a fund, right? Which we look at a lot of those metrics internally on a weekly basis during our weekly meetings. But we were able to really dive in and share those metrics with the investor and show them exactly how their portfolio is operating in good and bad capacities. And so that's been fun for us.
That's really cool. So any of the lessons learned you can pull out of there, equate it to somebody doing the same thing or somebody even just in one market center forever, any lessons learned that you could potentially expand on?
Yeah, I mean, don't do it just to do it if you're wanting to go to other markets. You know, we have done it intentionally. That was always the goal, because somebody could say, well, why don't you, you know, Phoenix is a big city. Why don't you just stay there until you get 3,000 or 4,000 units? And, you know, I mean, gosh, you could devote a lifetime to that. You know, Phoenix is so competitive. And so we had always wanted to be in other markets. And so that's what we're doing. So yeah, if you're considering other markets, just think about what you're good at and in your operations currently and what you're not good at. And maybe that'll help guide you to what needs to be done in your back office operation and what doesn't, you know,
it certainly made you get lean in the back office a little bit, you know, and kind of made you step up your game in the operation side.
Yeah. I really had to systematize things, and you know, KPIs with everything that we're doing and running it like a business, not running it like, you know, just a team of friends.
That's awesome. Where do you think the industry is going to go with some of the acquisition trends we're seeing? We're seeing big players come out with investor money, big players coming out with Wall Street money, going out and snagging up management companies. Where do you think the industry is heading? And talk about some of that.
Yeah, you know, that's been kind of fun to watch just in the short time I've been in the business and whatever participation I've been able to have in it is, you know, there's a lot of talk of acquisitions and that the industry is going to be quote unquote rolled up and all of that. And, you know, I've attempted several on my own. And property managers are a very hardy, headstrong group. And we don't want to, most people that I've talked to don't want to just get a check and go away. They've started their business and it's a family business and they've put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into the deal. So a lot of times they don't want to just get that check and go away. And a lot of times it's not, for what management companies are trading for at the moment, it's not enough money to go right off into the sunset. So there's a, you know, hey, I'm 50 years old and, you know, I'm going to get 1.5 times revenue for my company. Well, great. That gets me to 57, but then what, am I going to live on Social Security? So, you know, I think acquisitions is an opportunity. I think, you know, a lot of efficiencies can be brought to these local operators by using economies of scale somehow, some way. And, you know, I think the opportunity is being able to come in and support those local operators and help them build their business and support them where they're weak, which is a lot of times operationally. Maybe they are okay operationally, but they've got a lot of extra staff that's killing the profitability of the business. And so the owner's not being able to reap the rewards of the risk of owning a business. So, I think that's an opportunity that we're working on, is being able to come in to a market and formulate it and structure it, kind of like I was able to see in the automotive world.
In your acquisition efforts, what were some of the roadblocks that stopped everything? And basically, some of the resistance you got from people that basically came to you and said, hey, I'm looking to sell.
Yeah, those are the funny ones, yeah.
Yeah, and then they, at the end of the day, they don't.
So it's very rarely about the money. That was one of the lessons that I learned in an attempt to overpay for a company. So I was way overpaying based off the quote-unquote standards. And it came to it, that wasn't it. They concerned about changing the name and the legacy issues of this business that they had created, however big or small it was, and what they were going to do or what their role was going to be in life and in business after that. So those were the hangups, and it's understandable. You know, I mean, you can negotiate and quote-unquote argue price, but that's the other stuff is stuff that you can't necessarily argue because it's valid. It's real life stuff. So those are some of the things that came up, and that's why I think being able to come in and support somebody like that and help them grow versus, hey, here's a check, go away now.
So as an industry, you've been seeing what type of levels for acquisitions? Kind of talk a couple multiples with us for, let's say, a multiple of gross revenue, mm-hmm. or is it going to be a multiple of profit, EBITDA? So kind of see where you are in that. And, you know, there's no right or wrong. It's just kind of, let's throw it out there.
You know, just being, you know, I'm a nerd when it comes to business. I love learning and just paying attention to what's going on in other industries. And obviously we can't be compared to tech and what their multiples are. So nearly all the acquisitions that take place at the moment in our industry are property manager to property manager. You know, I'm going to buy your portfolio and roll that into mine.
So they're more of a merger versus an acquisition, go away acquisition.
I mean, to an extent, you know, where maybe the other party is not participating anymore, so it is an acquisition, but it's not a financial buyer, right? So they're buying you off a multiple of revenue because they're going to strip out all of your overhead and, you know, bring in, add very little expense associated with it, and they're going to bring in all the revenue that you have. And so you're selling to another property manager. Until we're able to get into a spot and get an entity big enough to be attractive to a financial buyer, we're not going to ever be purchased on a multiple of EBITDA. And so, I think that's possible. And I think there's a lot of buyers out there that would do it. But you got to get a good system. You got to be big enough, location-wise, unit-wise, revenue-wise, profit-wise, to be attractive to somebody like that. And it's got to be a big enough outfit to, you know, have all the systems in place where you got general managers, you got, presidents and everything that's running the operation, and they can come in and buy it and it continues to be a viable deal. But currently we're in a situation where, you know, if I come buy your company, Brad, well now who the heck's going to run the thing? Who's going to be the broker? And all of those things that have to be figured out. So yeah, you know, it's an interesting time in the industry. It's a maturing industry constantly. The acquisition thing has gotten a lot of press, you know, within the last couple of years, and there's a lot of big names that are going up there and doing it. So it'll just be interesting to see kind of what continues to happen.
Talk through the correlation between the two examples we used earlier with the automobile industry and the waste management industry, how that directly will or is going to relate to the property management industry and what you're seeing. So essentially, do you think there's an opportunity to come together with some sort of entity and maybe even get traded at a larger scale? Kind of talk me through what you think there.
Well, I mean, just quickly, I mean, Wayne Huizenga took a trash company and made it publicly traded, you know? So anything's possible, for heaven's sake, because, you know, 15 years before it went public, you know, via waste management, it was, you know, individual guys with one garbage truck driving around to 50 houses.
So clearly it's been done. It's been done before. And so the property management industry, for example, is probably ripe for that. For somebody to come along and offer some roll-up opportunity, offer some acquisition merger opportunity to create a larger entity that could potentially trade at a higher multiple.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, it's, you know, property management has kind of gotten some attention from Wall Street just because of all the, acquisitions of single family residential properties that was done when everything crashed, you know, the Blackstones and all the hedge funds. And so it's via that, it's gotten a lot of attention and become, you know, it's gotten, we're finally not the, the ugly duckling of the real estate world. We at least have some credibility now.
I see this as happening on an imminent level, because there's only so much in management fees that we can charge. As a management company in any market, I think we're either tapped out at this point or it's going to continue to reduce with some discount companies coming into their market. So I think the management fee revenue as a whole has flatlined. Would you agree with that?
Sure. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, to keep it fair and to continue to add value, you can add fees just to add fees. I'm of the opinion that you should add a fee where you could add value. If at some point it's tough to continue to deliver value for the fee.
So essentially the only way to continue to make money or increase in any way, shape or form your profits is to reduce overhead. And reducing overhead through economies of scale may be one of the best solutions of a potential group effort of management companies coming together and basically reducing their overheads at a large scale.
Sure, because when you hear reduce overhead, and so for the individual operator that's got 200 units in whatever town, that's like, well, that means, and what I would be thinking when I had 200 units was like, well, okay, now I have to fire half of my staff, and that means I get to do more? Like, that sounds like a terrible proposition. In a situation where you're big enough, you're right, you can reduce overhead, and you can do a better job, right? Your clients can actually get served better. Because you tie into something that's a little bit bigger and that has good systems, good processes, and the personnel to carry those out.
All still with the secret sauce on the ground. The broker, the leasing agents, all of that still in place. I think that's very dynamic. So where do you think this is kind of going, towards the goals and the end game? Kind of where do you think the industry as a whole is going, especially with your business and some of the ventures that you're taking on now?
Yeah, so we're kind of in that spot where we're working with a couple of guys that we're doing that for them, coming in and effectively helping them out with operations, taking a small equity stake in the business. So hopefully increasing the value of the equity of their company by tying into a larger, regional entity.
And that's a small equity stake. It's not a majority share to where you're going to squeeze them out. It's just a little taste.
Yeah, they've still got majority interest, right? Like, some cases.
And then there's always opportunities there for them to just say, all right, throw up your hands, I'm out, buy me out. And there's ways for them to do that effectively to where they're not turning it over to some entity that doesn't have any sort of knowledge about what they're doing.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So they're getting back to a spot where they're liking business again because they're doing the things that they enjoy. And, the things that they didn't enjoy were hiring and firing personnel, when you got two property managers and the one just decides to up and quit and you go into that tailspin of like, oh my gosh, here we go again. Getting away from that. So getting a little bit of life back. So we take on some of those frustrations and are able to absorb some of that on our end. And they get the upside of increased value, growing their markets again, by using some of our marketing methods. And so, I think it's a good opportunity. I feel like it's a good win-win. I think we're really able to add value for their clients. I think we're really able to add value for them by increasing the value of their businesses. They're making more money. So I think it's a win-win type of a deal. It's not the type of situation where it's like, hey, here's a check, go away now. It's a partnership approach because, some of these people have been in these markets for 25 years. They know what's going on. They know the people. They're involved in NARPM. They're well-respected in their chapters. They can stay involved in those things that fire them up. And, we can take on some of the things operationally that, they weren't able to achieve or really drive the ball forward on.
I think it's a great solution because you're going to see a lot of people that their whole identity is wrapped up into their business.
It's their family.
That's
all
they've
done. I can tell you, I grew up as a mechanic's son. My dad owned a mechanic shop in New Mexico. That's what you talked about around the dinner table, right? As a kid, that's what we talked about. Business was slow, business was good. This happened with that customer. It's a family conversation that, it goes deeper than just getting a check.
It is because there is no Michael Jackson walk away money here. We're not going to be selling our app to Facebook or Google for, nine figures. Our businesses are more in the realistic range of value. So that's, people have to consider that. We always say, well, I'm going to sell my business at the end. Well, when you get to the end and you look at the value of your business and you look at what that can get you on today's market, it's not crazy money. It's good money. Don't get me wrong, but it's not buy an island in the South Caribbean and move there on your private plane. We have to get a little bit more realistic on that. All right. So if somebody wanted to get in touch with you, tell us how to best reach you.
Yeah. Tim. So TIM at SGIPropertyManagement.com. Shoot me an email. Happy to get back to you. Talk about any of this stuff. If you're looking for all the answers, I probably don't have them, but I'm happy to show you all the ways that we messed things up so that if you're looking to do something similar, you know, maybe it'll save you some heartache.
Tim, it's been a great time talking to you. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Appreciate you having me.
Yep, take care.
Today's show is sponsored by the National Property Management Network, providing insurance products and services to property managers such as tenant liability insurance. Visit them at nationalpropertymanagement.com.
This has been a podcast episode by propertymanagementproductions.com. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast, leave us feedback, and come back for our next episode.